Okay, thanks very much, Rachel. I'm very glad to be here to talk with Corinne about this fascinating body of work that she's produced at Garden State. So I think what we'll do is talk about the work in some detail, both upstairs and downstairs, and then kind of together, and talk about some of its wider implications and a little bit about how it relates to some of the things you've done earlier. And then, indeed, we'll throw it over to the audience so you get your go. So maybe we'll start with what's around us here, gardening the suburbs. It's a very interesting selection of photographs and this hang. And well, maybe first just say something about how you came to this project and how you chose to fix on gardening and on suburbia as well, perhaps.
Well, I've been working... I think what brought me to this geographical region was work that I'd been making sort of the 3 or 4 years before in southern Spain and northern Morocco, and thinking about the porosity of the border between Europe and Africa, and thinking about what the landscape represents, how you see human mobility and trade and occupation played out in the landscape and the way that it's shaped, and thinking about agriculture in southern Spain and the southern Spain as an entry point from North Africa for a lot of particularly young men entering into Europe. And then had been thinking about photography and the sort of photographic lineage that I have maybe in some way I'm part of and I'm also disrupting, and thinking about this legacy of photographers such as Timothy O'Sullivan, who were working in the American West, who were paid to go there to make this landscape look a particular way, to make it look as if it was empty desert, ripe for colonization, and how there were photographers such as Francis Frith, who came to the Holy Land looking for a biblical landscape and couldn't actually find it because it was an occupied landscape, but shaped the photographs in such a way that people just became decorative and didn't look as if they were actually claiming the land in any way. And thinking about how they were representing landscape and the built landscape, and then people who've come... I was really just getting to a point where I was switching on to the kind of photographic language I was using, and my sort of early work was made in a very instinctive way, but of course it's not instinctive, it's learned. The instincts are learned, they're learned from looking at other people's work. So thinking about those who work with vernacular architecture and Walker Evans, and then the new topographics and Lewis Boltz and all the pictures that I'm really attracted to, and thinking about where I sit in amongst them, and particularly this sort of language of the very wide vista of the landscape, of dominating the landscape through the photograph, and the relationship of photography and colonialism, and how photography since its inception has been used as a tool of colonialism, as has botany, you know, as has planting. So being aware of those languages and thinking about the regions that those people were working in, so the US-Mexican border and Israel-Palestine, and thinking about relationships then between these geographical regions in terms of these desert border spaces, or sites, contested desert territories, and how they've been used photographically. So I think I went to Israel-Palestine in 2009, 2010, and just to see, not necessarily with an intention to make any work, and also very cautious about trying to make work in a place that I really didn't know anything about, and sort of feeling my way through and thinking, well... And also I've been reading A.R. Weizmann's Hollow Land, and he's wrote that a lot about the civilian occupation, and I think that just switched me onto a particular way of reading this landscape, which is not looking at the militarized landscape. Or really, for me as well, I mean, we worked together on the Brighton Biennial, and that was actually a really informative period for me to be looking at images of violence and war and the militarized violent landscape, and where the limitations with that are in terms of photojournalism, and how, for me, how I might turn away. You know, that was very much about how do you turn away, or how do you find ways to engage people to think beyond what's present in the image.
I mean, in fact, in that Brighton photo biennial, which is relevant perhaps in a couple of ways, it was called Memory of Fire, and it was from 2008. It was about images of of warfare and the war of images. But we showed some Bloomberg and Channerin from the Chicago Project, which say, you know, which is about the Israeli state and its sort of landscape constitution, partly. And those were very large, very expansive landscapes of surveillance, and rather sublime, in fact, in their effect. And what you offer us here is completely different, obviously. I mean, these small square images of details, mostly fragments of landscapes, mostly closed off with barriers of one kind or another. A lot of marking of ownership going on in various ways, through planting, but also through walls and so on. And very few, I mean, maybe that's one of the only exceptions, that single picture on the wall over there is about the only one which gives you something of a vista, right? So there's a huge sense of claustrophobia here, so maybe you can talk about that a little.
Yeah, and I think that comes from thinking about disrupting this, you know, I work with landscape, but really disrupting this showing of offering lots of information, and instead thinking what potentials are there and what restrictions are there, and actually how much can you say with photography about a set of conditions in this place? So how might I suggest that, and how might I ask the viewer to almost work with, not give the viewer much, but then ask them to work with that, which perhaps I hope has a more lasting resonance. And that's through, as you noted, this very almost claustrophobic way that I'm making these pictures. So this room installation maps 22 Israeli settlements that I travelled to that start around the coastal area, around Tel Aviv. So these are settlements that were built around 48, and they were classified as new towns, and they were built to encourage people to move out, to not be just based in Tel Aviv, but to occupy territory. And then as you move around the installation, and it gets more, sort of more dense around here, this is the Green Line, and also Route 6, which is a very important road that runs, you know, straight through the territory. And in recent, you know, the recent wars in Gaza, it's where the Israeli military drive their tanks down. So it's very strategic military. They've placed it very strategically for military purposes, but they also have this function of being a suburban, a garden suburb. And then as you move round, you go beyond the Green Line into the West Bank, and there they become much more like outposts. And as you say, these are the only places that I sort of show a glimpse of what lies beyond, and wanting to make this suggestion of this ever marching forward.
Right.
But, and not showing any aspect of the militarized landscape in these pictures. So suggesting, all these frontiers and borders and divisions through fences, but actually choosing to not include any of the very violent landscape that was there immediately surrounding these places. Mm-hmm. Because what struck me was how powerful the combined military-civilian occupation is, purely simply because it doesn't, because these are all places that look so familiar, that could be anywhere, and of this very sort of generic garden design.
So was that the attraction of suburbia, in a sense, because of its ordinariness, rather than to take a big city or to and look at nature there, or to take the kibbutz
And to kind of for me, a very the pictures that I have in my imagination of Palestine and of these very militarized landscapes, these very violent landscapes, don't seem to take me anywhere. They're so different from the experience I had when I was photographing in one of these places, which was just one of the settlements that overlooks Hebron, and really feeling the violence of that place, but realizing that for me the photograph of it doesn't recreate that. So going, doing a huge about turn and doing something that's much more about the sort of the banality and innocence of these places, and this tricky combination of a Zionist neoliberal agenda. So here it's about the Israeli state wanting to put these suburbs in specific places to do strategically, so they cut off Palestinian villages from one another, for example. But it's also about developers being able to get all the land in the West Bank for free, because it's all confiscated land, so they can there's a lot of money flying around.
When you talked about the layout, it suggests that there's a kind of logic or a mapping going on here. Can you say something about that?
Yes, and that was so it's a broken grid. It loosely maps the 22 settlements as they move around from the coastal area into the Jordan Valley. And I purposefully only made photographs in what the Israeli state classifies as quality of life settlements. And I see it as being one slice of, one layer of, multiple layers of landscape that one could have looked at. So as you said, I could have looked at the kibbutzim, and I didn't. And I didn't look at the, I haven't looked at Palestinian villages, towns, settlements. I haven't looked at the Israeli settlements that are people with, you know, a generator and two caravans on top of a hill.
Right.
I've looked at these settlements that come back, that are sold as being quality of life, that are sold as being a garden suburb, that are sold as being somewhere very convenient to get to your job in Jerusalem, but you can't afford a flat in Jerusalem, but you can afford a whole house and a garden in this settlement that then changes its nature. In the imagination, in the Israeli imagination, it changes its nature. It becomes it becomes part of this facade of.
So there's something very interesting and odd in a sense about the Israel as a sort of neoliberal state, which is in certain ways it is, but rather like the US, it's at the same time highly interventionist in certain ways and has to be. In order to maintain its security, and a lot of the planting that you show here is actually, it's not done by individuals, is it? It's done by sort of municipal authorities of one kind or another. So I'm just wondering what kind of an ideal of the garden suburb perhaps is floating around in this. Is that something that you have a handle on?
You mean an ideal in terms of how they, the sort of image that they're trying to create? Or, well, I think what I observed was the how the territory changes and how the gardens and the plants change as you move through the territory. So all this coastal area now, they're all there. They're in, they're in what's classed as Israel, so that they're not in threat of being moved, and the state doesn't put any money into them. They're all quite poor, so the white picket fences are actually made of plastic, and the plants come from quite a small plant pool. I've just spent 2 days with a botanist at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh talking about these plants, and she was saying, well, they'll have got them from, there'll be like 50 plants that they cultivate from the local plant nursery, so that's why there's this very generic kind of garden style going on. Whereas when you get to the Green Line, everything gets a lot more lush. There's more money is put, more state money is put into these settlements, and people are encouraged to live there. So military families in particular are invited to live in the settlements that hug the Green Line and hug this main motorway, this main artery. And they'll give people tax incentives to live there. And then as you move across into the West Bank, my feeling was that these... the gardens become more wild. It was very interesting for me to think about, and I don't really know much about gardening, but I know enough to know that, for example, a French garden is this very kind of, public gardens, very ordered and very structured, where the English model is to appear to be quite wild. But actually, of course, it's all cultivated and very carefully positioned, but then it'll be kind of messed up a bit. And I've had the sense of that with some of these places, that they look very dense and lush, but you can then see if you look a bit closer that actually they've not been there that long, and the rocks that weren't there already, they were placed in for different reasons. So almost like an emulating a biblical landscape that exists in the European imagination.
So behind these ideals there's something very uninnocent going on, in fact, about the variegation of these landscapes, the expense that's put into them, the kinds of planting that takes place, and so on. So I guess I wonder also, in a way that there's a way in which we can see some of this planting as a claim to ownership, as an assertion, we have laboured over this land, therefore it's ours. There's something of that going on. There's something too about you know, in many of these, an extreme order as well, you know, the of the built landscape and the ordering of plants within a kind of, you know, very tightly regulated nature. But I wonder, too, in some of the pictures, do you see other elements of resistance, of chaos, of unregulated growth? Is there something that we can set against all this sort of instrumentality, which also you seem to reflect in the very order of your photography as well? And I wonder how deliberate that is, too, in that this is a, you know, quite...
Yeah, the square is a very deliberate.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't used this camera for a long time. It just felt very appropriate for this project because there's something about it becoming this about classification somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to go back to what you were saying about it feeling quite claustrophobic and the lack of information I'm giving with each image and the lack of depth, not depth of field, but depth of... there's a sort of flatness as an idea for me about them being this, about this sort of facade that is very much about the imagination and what we hold in the imagination before something can be constructed. It exists in the imagination. And how fragile is this? How fragile is this facade? Are the points of rupture, as you say, are the, can we see these breaking points? And I think they're suggested for me in moments where brickwork will meet rock and it might not fit quite properly. Or there's one picture which I'm particularly interested in, this one, and it's very hard to see at a distance, but this is one of the only times that I show a wall, like a barrier wall, and then something that isn't cultivated beyond it, and there's some grasses either side. And it's interesting for me to, I was discussing this with the botanist yesterday, with would they have been planted and they've seeped over, or is it the other way around? And one of the things I'm doing with her for the book, which I'm working on this summer, is to think about the potential future of this place. So one of my main aims with this is to raise questions about, okay, so here's the mechanics of this, here's the mechanics of the Israeli state played out in the in this context of militarized civilian occupation. So then how might we find those points of weakness or fracture or potential? And we were talking about how will the plants cope in the future without water if these places were decolonized. Would they thrive? Would they survive? Would they cling on? Would they sort of, how much flexibility is there? How much agency do the plants have? Which she wasn't able to answer.
You were mentioning Timothy Sullivan before, and you know, that American pioneer landscape, you know, plainly in which photography is serving as an agent of colonization, and the traditions that come out of that. And there's a really interesting essay by Benjamin Booklow about that work, in which he sees a kind of dialectic between a mourning, both a sort of instrumental view, which is a sort of mapping view, the idea that we're going to take this virgin territory as it was considered, and we're going to, you know, we're going to operate within it and on it, but also a melancholia running through those images of, you know, there's this wilderness will, as a result, be destroyed. So, and that's already sort of woven into those pictures. And it's curious, but looking at these images, so it's already happened, right, in your images, but I wonder whether that similar interplay, in a sense, of melancholia and instrumentality going on, that we're perhaps, you know, that there's a ghost behind them, which is of the landscape that was there before, or something of that sort.
And that comes into, if you know how to read the landscape, doesn't it, and how you read the plants. Mm. It was really interesting for me to show this work in Jordan last year, and to have people from the region experience this work when I showed it at photo gallery, and the way that they read it in a way that I can't, because they know the carob tree in somebody's garden that isn't being used for the purposes it would be used for elsewhere in the region, or a kind of recognition of the plants and trees, and that will echo what was there before, or very obvious, it was very painful to show it in Jordan because people had such an emotional reaction.
Mm.
Because there was that real understanding of this being layered over what was there before that they could still feel and imagine.
I remember going to this seaside town in Spain and talking to all the people there who remembered when the whole place was a forested slope of pines going down to the sea. And that this new town had basically been established, and they'd cut down most of the pines, but there were left as urban decoration with some of these older pines growing in place still. So they were older than the town, which had been sort of built around them, and you know they'd been kind of paved in with concrete, obviously, and all that. And I just wonder, looking at these things too, that sometimes you see boulders which seem to have been too large to be moved or blown up or whatever. And also, presumably, older trees. There seem to be older trees sometimes. So that survival's in the sense of what was there before.
Yeah. And have people constructed buildings and settlements around them.
Mm.
But also, as well, it'd be interesting then to think about the other layer of the nostalgia that exists, or how this, if we think about how these places might transform in the future and how these plants function might transform. So I was thinking about somewhere there's olive trees very neatly planted in rows with rocks around them that aren't being used for they're not being harvested.
Mm.
But I don't know enough about them to know could they begin to be cultivated for their, for food rather than the sort of visual pleasure that's what they give now. Mm. So I wonder then if another layer of...
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. Okay, well, maybe we'll talk about your installation downstairs, Wounded. And again, perhaps you can say a little bit about how you came to that and what you decided to...
Okay, so I took the photographs in 2010, and it was maybe my second or third visit to the region, and I arrived and there'd been 2 weeks after there'd been this huge devastating forest fire in the Carmel Forest, which is north of Haifa, which is I think one of the biggest Israeli national parks, and it killed about 40 people had died. It wasn't an arson, they didn't think it was a natural forest fire. And it seemed to be this incredible wound to the Israeli psyche. Not only had people died, but it was, the forest has such symbolism for so many people, but particularly there it has, it's extremely symbolic, and it's symbolic of making the desert bloom, Ben-Gurion's mission to transform the landscape, and for various reasons and various sort of strategies involved in why one would plant forests to claim territory. It's then designated as a national park. People can't abuse it or build on it. Or it also obviously covers over or helps to cover over Palestinian villages that were lost in 1948. And it also is useful, again, for the Israeli state to be able to move people around for population dispersal, because people are particularly a lot of Somalians and Russians who are coming into Israel get employment in afforestation and are then sort of sent around the country to work planting in different areas. So forests have different uses, but there's also this very sort of symbolic reading. So anything that's taken, it felt like a feeling of people having really had something taken away from them with the burning of this forest. So I went up there and made this series of photographs and made them thinking about I was also thinking very much about the language of landscape photography that I'm using and subjectivity, and wanting to really thinking much more about the process of making photographs and being there and being present, and wanting to have my presence felt. When you see the work, you remember that there was somebody there making that photograph, and that they're only including that much information and something else was happening that you don't know about, rather than being presented with this wide vista that seems to contain all the information. So for that reason, I made them sort of very face on at human scale, almost treating these burnt trees with their red sort of charred branches as making them as portraits, and then wanted to follow that through in the way that I hung the work. So again, this sort of very subjective physical encounter with them, and being able to, and thinking about the photograph not as as a 2D image, but also as an object, and what agency that object then has.
So you have to move around the space,
yeah,
rather as you would move through a forest,
yeah,
with trees. Is that,
yeah,
right? Yeah,
and you encounter them on a very bodily level, and you there's this also something about looking behind and there not being anything. Again, for me, thinking about the facade and the flatness of the image. But then I returned in 2013 to the same forest, which had been left. They'd done a lot of tests, soil tests, and a lot of predictions about what might happen. But so this was a planted forest. It was mostly Aleppo pine and oak. And but what happened when I returned 3 years later was it was now sort of waist chest height in the flora that had been there before, and the native flora had been allowed to bloom again. Because what I learned was that so each forest has its own flora, would attract its own flora and fauna, and that changes a lot when you plant a forest, because you often plant them very densely. So that in this case, the pine needles on the ground stop other flora being able to grow up. So as soon as they've gone, there's room again, and there's room for these other plants to breathe. But rather than photographing it, I decided to make this sound recording of me pulling my way through, walking through, tripping over, and then have that in the sort of hold you in the space, a surround sound, which I think makes it interesting for me. It's a very gentle suggestion about these cycles of occupation.
So there's a big contrast, really, I mean, in lots of ways, between the upstairs and the downstairs. And, I mean, there's obviously a kind of... The downstairs shows, in one way, a massive eruption of contingency and chaos in the form of the fire and what happens in this uncontrolled growth afterwards. And also in the darkness of that installation the relative lack of... everything in these images seems quite tied down. Everything there is much freer, and there's a much narrower band of focus, for instance, which perhaps suggests a particular act of looking and attention. I don't know if you have more to say about that.
Yeah. It's interesting to think then about how they speak to one another, and how maybe the work downstairs, wounded, can be used to read this, perhaps to think more into the potentials for rupture within these places.
Yeah.
One of the things that I really enjoyed working with the botanist was that I'd asked her to identify some plants in these pictures that were of interest, and for the book she's writing these small narratives. One of the first ones she picked out was this one, and she said, okay, this is from South Africa, this is from I don't know where, and look, here's a weed that's just taking advantage of the fact that it's near a water pipe. And she made me tune into things that I'd not been aware of when I was taking the pictures. Plants clinging onto rocks. The picture on the back wall up there has some advantageous weed flora that had sprung up as a result of the earth being turned for whatever development they're going to do there. That may or may not be native. It may have come from down the road from another South African plant, or So her way to read into these is thinking, I think, about these sort of more layers and more possible alternatives.
With the forest and with trees in particular, there's a more overtly ideologically charged scene going on, especially, as you say, trees for both sides. The Palestinians, the olive trees in particular, are seen as, not only economically hugely important, but symbolically important. And Israeli punishment squads will often uproot those trees and destroy them, of course. And there's a way in which forest planting is used as a sort of a way of marking borders with a Palestinian territory, for instance, so they're farming stops where the forest starts, And the Israelis use forests in all sorts of ways. I mean, certainly to assert ownership, as you say, and control over the land, but also the planting of sort of so-called security groves, so as to prevent, you know, surveillance over particular areas of the land, and so on. So, so in a way, your photography of the destruction of such a large swathe of this forest, and one which is seen by the Israelis as a national wound, is quite an overt political statement, and I just wonder whether it's been picked up on at all, and whether, you know, what kind of how people received this work. Has it been picked up by Zionists, for instance?
Well, there was an enormous stream of it was covered. Somebody did a feature, an online. Where's Rachel? Is she here? There was an enormous sort of backlash against a really. What was it in the Middle East? The Electronic Intifada. Yes, there was a stream of. Which got removed, interestingly. Which raises questions about rights to.
So can you say a bit more about that?
I actually didn't read them. I didn't want to read them because obviously I'm aware that that I feel a sense of vulnerability in putting this work out in the world, a massive sense of responsibility, and that I make myself very vulnerable. Mm. So I actually didn't read any of the comments that were saying that it was all a load of rubbish. I think was probably the general gist. No, but it's interesting. I think people take or read the work downstairs to be more of to think more about cycles of colonization and occupation and reoccupation. Mm. And with this work, and I mean that's, yes, I'm looking at this specific region and this specific set of conditions, and I think it also speaks to other patterns of colonization around the world, and, you know, the suburban gated community that is becoming more and more popular, and the ideas of separation and protection and luxury that these places suggest. Because the other thing about these gardens, of course, is their status as their luxury places. They're using water that is being restricted from, you know, Palestinian water use is restricted, and the water's used for not for growing food, but for, was your phrase, conspicuous consumption?
Yeah, indeed. Obviously, I mean the very act of growing, elaborate plants and gardens in a desert situation is just such an act. I mean, it's very similar to what you see in Las Vegas with these huge water features outside the casinos. This is just, we can do this, at least until recently. So I wonder, I mean, obviously within the, knowing that these are shot in Israel, and within a particularly charged situation, it gives them a particular inflection. But I wonder too, just going on from what you were saying, whether there's a, that they raise broader issues about the regulation of nature, the way in which ownership is marked, the ideals of suburbia. I mean, some of them remind me a bit of, if you know Nils Norman's work about the way in which zones of ownership and surveillance are marked out in the city. And, this was photographic work which bears on Lefebvre's Right to the City work. A long time before there was controversy about this, he was photographing things like, serrated bumps on buildings to stop people going to sleep and that kind of thing. Or little metal barriers to keep people out of particular areas, all of this. And planting, of course, can be used in that way too. So I just,
To direct, and I think something that has been really important to me in terms of the way that I read place and I read landscape is a very good friend who was studying landscape architecture when I was first studying photography, and we'd go for walks around the city. We were studying in Barcelona, and we'd go for walks around the city, and we'd go into a square, and she'd tell me, she'd just teach me how to read that place. Where are the streetlights? Who would feel safe here? Why is that bench not useful where it is? Why is the curb like that? How, you know, and so now I'm always reading, well, can somebody get their pushchair down this road? Or, you know, and yeah. how are we manoeuvred around place, particularly urban space? But yeah, as you say, it happens, you know, it happens in seemingly more wild places because, you know, all these human-shaped spaces, how we're controlled when we go for a walk, where we're supposed to look at the view.
I wondered, in relationship to... this is possibly a difficult question, but let's try it. So you were talking before about... getting the viewer to do quite a bit of work, in a sense, that you offer them fragments. They have some awareness, at least through reading something about the exhibition, of the wider situation. And you know, there's an elaborate reading room out there and as well, if they choose to inform themselves further. But this seems to be quite a regular form of gallery and museum photography is to offer these fragments, in a sense, and to which are elusive, I suppose. They're not the detailed descriptions offered by photojournalism at its best. They're something quite other than that. And as you say, to let the viewer sort it out. So I'm wondering how you think they will do that, and what kind of illusions you are making in these. Works.
And how many tools I provide or choose to provide, and that very difficult balance, I think, about how much I show and how much I expect of people. And if I expect people to be bothered to come in and think, right, I'm not reading this, and will I stay with it? Will I give it some attention? I think that's the thing that one hopes when somebody's in a gallery or museum context, that somebody's there to put some, to give some energy and attention. But it was interesting for me to show the work in Jordan, where I thought that people would be able to read these pictures very easily, and the curator there being very clear that she didn't want to have much text. But then realising afterwards that this work does need some text. It does need some navigating. I don't think the work downstairs does. And so now I have these, I don't know if anybody's picked them up, these sort of fold-out brochures, because I felt that there are some key bits of information that one needs to know in order to be able to read this in this context, which is the map of Israel, the map of where the settlements are, where the roads are. The shape that it takes. And so, I think it's a really difficult one. I am asking people to do some work, and I'm hoping that that work pays off, because that's my experience when I come out somehow to meet the work. It lingers for longer. And I think one of the things, you mentioned the reading room, one of the things that's been really key with this show, so it's a partnership with the University of the Arts London, where I'm a research fellow, Photo Gallery Cardiff and the Mosaic Rooms. And what's been key for us in planning the show is how we contextualise it and what the events programme is, and how we don't just throw this out there, but we create something... a place for there to be more dialogue. So you can go and sit in the reading room, and people have gone and sat in the reading room for hours and looked through everything, and all my stuff that I brought back from different NGOs, and all the books that I used as part of my research, and then books that have come from the bookshop here. But then also, for example, the pop-up garden outside, which has been made by Small World Urbanism, who are a collective based in Brixton. So there's been permaculture workshops. There's been ways of thinking about these issues in the context of here, London, and this not becoming something that's disconnected from us, but thinking about the politics of planting in lots of different contexts.
And you were planning a book around this, so I mean, do you have an idea of what kind of contextual material, if that's the right word, indeed, you will be offering
It's in that. Yeah, and rather than wanting to do an exhibition catalogue, I was very clear that it should be around this work. So the book's called Garden State, but it's just working with this 53 plates from this series and thinking, having that interesting transition from thinking about how an exhibition operates and how a sort of room installation operates to how a book operates and what can be inserted into a book and into that. So there's a conversation with me and A.R. Weisman, which is sort of offering the political context and also raising questions about the potential future of these places in terms of how he's thinking about architecture of revolution and decolonization and the fact that NASA reads all these settlements from their satellite imagery shows a sea of yellow desert and then these blobs of green. So it doesn't read the settlements as buildings, it reads them as forest. Mm. So plant thinking, in a way, introducing this idea of how these places might change. So there's our conversation, there's an essay by curator Val Williams, which will be talking about the photographic language, and then I've been working with Sabina Nees, a botanist at the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh, who's a Middle Eastern plant specialist, who's sort of travelling back and forth constantly and knows, and thinking about those, the links between botany and planting and colonisation and how just getting into very sticky territory in a way about in terms of working with her and that whole other classification system, like mapping, like photography. But again, how a section by her might introduce questions for potential futures and also potential of reading these pictures in a very different way than I have read them.
Mm. Okay. I think, shall we open it to the audience? Yeah, Olga.
Thank you so much. This has been a really interesting talk. The one thing, of course, in this room looking at these images, is what becomes really striking is the absence of people, the kind of subjectivity you touched upon in relation to the work downstairs. Here it seems very striking. And of course, for me, it's very much the tradition of the new topographics. Mm. And perhaps it also goes some way to talking about the context as well, whether the presence of people could have made it a bit more recognizable in terms of the context, in terms of the issues, whether the kind of the exclusion of people kind of makes it more of a conceptual work perhaps, or more of a, I don't know how to describe it. Yeah, kind of takes it away a little bit from the very live issues that you're very interested in. That's just a provocation.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Go on.
I think it's interesting, yeah. And I haven't worked with people. I mean, I do my video works, but I haven't actually worked with imaging people for a long time and feel that it, for me, just cuts through for me to something that's immediately emotive, whereas that almost stops my thinking around a set of conditions. But also, it would have been incredibly hard to photograph people in this place because there's nobody in these places. It's like a lot of these sort of gated communities where people just drive. There's loads and loads of roundabouts.
They also feel really empty, so people haven't moved in yet.
Yeah.
As if they're built, but nobody actually lives there.
Which, in some cases, is true because there's a lot of private investors will pay to have buildings made that are never occupied, but they're there and they're facts on the ground.
It would have been interesting to... I mean, I wonder how they would be altered if you had photographed the labourers who do the planting or the watering or, the maintenance, the weeding.
Who I had long conversations with, actually, particularly down there in Ma'ali Adumim. Lots of all Palestinian workers telling me about the trees, telling me about wanting me to share in their pleasure in the olive tree that was planted in the middle of a roundabout that had been taken from somewhere else and put there.
Fascinating. So, there and then.
I'm slightly away from my character, so I just wondered about access. How did you get access, and how much time did you have to take the images, and what were the conversations that arose while you were
Yeah, no, we didn't discuss that. I was able to access everywhere. All these were gated. Well, the beyond the green line, these are all gated settlements with a gate person and an electronic gate that goes up automatically because I'm in a car with Israeli plates and I could look as if I'm visiting there. So getting access wasn't a problem. I had a number of different encounters with people wanting to know what I was doing in a friendly way, people wanting to know what I was doing in an aggressive way, being filmed, being photographed by people. And in Ariel, being pursued by sort of plain clothes, walkie-talkie police. And I think, so it felt, it was a very strange tension between these seemingly idyllic places with bird song, and it was all very calm and beautiful, and this incredible anxiety I had about being there and conflict about being there. But also, this is when being a woman is quite, you know, people don't really see me as a threat in the same way that they might have had I been a man making photographs, and I'm making photographs of gardens, so that was often a point of shared mutual appreciation of these places. All that, but that conflict in me in having these conversations with people about how beautiful their garden was, and somebody asking me, I remember a woman asking me in, I think Mali Ephraim, somewhere over here, what are you doing here? You're at the end of the world. But yeah, I mean, I've got a European passport. It means I can travel on every road there. And yeah, I might get kicked out of the country, but other than that, I'm not really at risk at all. And I'm visiting places that most Palestinians, unless they're working there, haven't been to. And most Israelis, you know, so many Israelis haven't been there, because obviously there's a lot of Israelis that would never set foot in a settlement.
Did you ever have any comfortable situations where somebody invited you for tea or got all?
No, actually, that never happened. No.
Okay, yeah.
There is a strange sense of back and front in the images, in most of them. Actually, in all of them, except for one or two exceptions. There is always something, a visual element that sort of interrupts our vision, creates like a front layer and a back layer. Is there any comments on that? Is it like a metaphor for the situation, maybe? Like the things that are not visible because of something in front, like a wall, like a plant, like a rock. And there is like always a three-layer approach in your compositions. I was just wondering if there's a reason for it. Or
I think I was thinking very much about thinking about the construct. So the image at the top here, how deep you can go into this foliage, into the vegetation, and feeling that you can never get very deep because it. So wanting to not provide much depth, actually. But yeah, it's interesting that you say that actually you can see the layer behind.
Yeah,
and you
there's
can
no
see
depth in terms of visual elements or perspective because it's always interrupted with something,
yeah.
A wall, with a land. Or
yeah.
Trees or
yeah, so there's never
it's very interesting.
Historically, colonial and anti-colonial movements have often gendered landscape and nature, from virgin territories to Mother Earth. Does, as in Israel Palestine, has gender played a role in conceptualizing the landscape?
What, in terms of the way I'm thinking about it, or maybe that's something you can answer? I don't know.
I don't either, actually. Does anyone here have any knowledge of that?
No, it's a very interesting question.
Yeah.
But we've talked before about you being a woman walking in landscapes and working in a tradition of often male landscape photographers. Has it been something you've thought about at all?
Yeah, it's something I think about a lot, and I wonder how much to make it more present in my work, or how explicit that needs to be. And I've been making work recently in Spain and making a series of walks and then developing a performative talk from those walks, and thinking about psychogeography and how, and it's something that I haven't figured out. How is it different? How am I doing things differently? And do I want to make such a strict sort of gender division between the way that I would engage with wandering and getting lost and discovering in a place? Then is it as simple as that? I'm not sure, but it's something that's very present in terms of just being aware of the way that I work, yeah.
You were talking before about using the texts and the kind of giving people more information. And for me, it feels like the way it's presented represents kind of maybe like a naive European approach to these places, because they seem really quite beautiful at first, and then you understand the context. And it's only when you get more of a context that I think you can kind of come to, like you say, come to understand them. So I wondered if that's what you were trying to say with the, you know, giving us more information so that we can in some way replicate the experience of knowing already the context.
That's an interesting point about how you encounter this room, maybe particularly when you first come in, and that there is something engaging and beautiful about some of these places. There is like a lushness and a sensuality to some of these gardens, and I don't know if it come. I don't necessarily think it needs to come with reading a text, but the more that you look at them, there's a lot of repetition. There's the repetition of the supported sapling that you begin to see again and again. There's a lot of sort of mirroring, and a lot of repetition of garden style. And then you picked up on this, the claustrophobia, which is the way that I read them, and almost, yeah, having that sort of sense of beauty and shattered at some point through a longer looking.
I also wanted to ask, because I think I was there on Saturday, for the talk about permaculture. I remember during that it was said that a lot of the animals in the planted pine forest, there aren't many birds and you can't really hear animal song. And I wondered if you noticed, you know, much fauna around in these gardens, and did it feel kind of...
There were particularly when you get out into the Jordan Valley, there felt to be more wildlife. There were more birds, and this was something that the botanist was telling me about. Okay, this plant will attract this and this. So that's something that will come into these narratives that she's going to write. More so as you get around here, less so along the coastal areas.
I mean, this is maybe a slightly odd association, but I did, in looking at some of these, I did think about that J.M. Richards book about suburbia in England. This being a kind of conservative and populist defence of suburbia against especially modernist critics from the 1940s. And it was illustrated with drawings by John Piper, which give an extraordinary sense of this very lush, various, actually rather rich areas of suburbia, it seems to be. But, you know, with these houses with their fake historical details. But the planting, especially, having such a huge presence in them. And then Richard's writing about the richness and the variety and the life of these places, and trying to reclaim them, in a sense, for saying, you know, people like them for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But these images, it seems to me, are very far from that. I mean, there are, you know, gestures towards that kind of utopian sense, or it's not utopian, it's the wrong word, because these are very present places, obviously, but towards that ideal. But most of them are quite, I don't know, harsh, and they feel very over-regulated and over-ordered in a way that part of what Richards was saying there was these places are you know, they earn people's affections by a mix of orderliness and, you know, and chaotic growth, I suppose, and and an organic, you know, a growth of both the settlement and its history.
Whereas these are very manufactured in a way, they're very...
They feel tabula rasa, and then you put something, you know, I mean, many of them anyway, you know, this kind of thing. You know, it's just plainly false and not lived, or not yet.
Yeah. So that's, I think that, yeah, through time, will that change, and will there be a more of them? Yeah, how will sort of a sense of ownership of these places change, but how might the, yeah, the wild and the cultivated, all those sort of complicated definitions weave into one another?
In this regard, I was wondering whether you could say anything about the fact that you just presented them upstairs accompanied by a sound installation as well.
I think the sound very much for me was about wanting to make this subjective experience, make it very subjective, very physical bodily experience.
Could you talk a bit about the layout?
Yeah, so square format, so that it has this real sense of, how did I phrase it to you, that it's like a categorization of, and I felt that they should be small, it should be about volume, and wanting to suggest the geographical positioning of these settlements, but within that I play around because there's a combination of the sort of geographical locations and the formal relationship between the photographs as well, and wanting to have this sense of pace which changes with every space that I show it in, because when it was at Photo Gallery it was in a white cube, when I showed it in the McCann space in Jordan it was a house as well, so there were a lot of archways and it really moved around the space, and I'm interested in how it, particularly in this room, I love how it sort of communicates with the room itself, but wanting to have this density around the green line which mirrors the density of the suburban settlements around the green line, but then here as we move round it begins to loosely take this form of what Palestinians call the crocodile's jaw, which is the settlements as they move into the West Bank biting down and sort of separating that territory.
I'm quite interested in the process of making work, because you amazingly well articulate the whole kind of research around it, and I could see there is obviously, it's impossible to do such kind of work without research before, or even photographing that. But I'm still interested in that sort of a sense of when you go into the places, how much already you consciously photograph specific and frame them, or it still comes after the editing and when you're looking at the images and that sort of, it's still there. So how much is it pre-shooting and all my research done, and how much is the after? What is the process for?
I think when I went to, and knowing that I wanted to make work, I knew that I wanted to make work about gardens, about miniature landscapes and the civilian occupation. But I wasn't sure what those photographs would be, and I spent the first maybe two... I made a lot of work that sort of dead ends. I started photographing everywhere on these roundabouts in these new towns. There's olive trees that are plonked onto these roundabouts for decoration, and I started making photographs of them. And then I think what, for me, it's returning to a place again and again, and I can make something, I come back and I reflect on it, and when I'm there it's an extremely immersive experience because I'm out working, travelling every day, speaking to people, reading, and what films I'm watching, all those things are affecting the way that I'm looking, and then I go away and maybe come home and sit with the pictures for a while and I'm doing more theoretical reading and making connections between what I've discovered or I've learned to see through my own experience and theorising around these issues. And then the next time I go back, things get clearer and they get clearer. So, I mean, the work downstairs was made on one of my first trips, but it wasn't completed. I didn't know how it was going to be completed until one of my final trips 3 years later. And this work developed over three trips, but they were like, I think maybe I've been seven times, and they were like the last three times. There's a lot of that space of everything bubbling around but not being clear about, you know, the kind of the scary phase. There's a lot of the scary phase of not knowing how it's going to be resolved.
Anyone else?
Houses that are surrounded, that are walled in almost in their terms of privacy, in which you did, to refer to an earlier question, you did show the other in that form were the shanty houses and the trees with plastic sheeting, with makeshift sticks for the workers who are working in the fruit fields, the migrant workers. And that was a very strong contrast, and it's almost in this work like you have permeated that the wall without, and you are somehow representing some experience, perhaps, of, for instance, a Palestinian experience. You're coming in with that gaze, but in the earlier work, there was something about you kept a distance from these two very different communities.
Whilst also being conscious that I was... So that work is about... The work that you're talking about is almost using plastic as a material and metaphor to explore this border territory in southern Spain that's populated by the migrant golfers who live in their protected gated communities, and the irregular migrants who are working in the greenhouses and using plastic, as you say, to make their shanties. But there's something very fake and over the top and ostentatious about these sort of Disney-fied houses. But I was also very conscious of who am I in that? You know, just as I'm aware of who am I in this, I'm the one with a passport that can go anywhere. I'm the one that can go into these places that a lot of people, when I came back, were going, oh, what's it like? You know, really intrigued to know how it felt. And maybe like with the work downstairs, wounded, very consciously trying to bring myself and my presence as a photographer and my role into the work, whereas with the mirror, with the series that you're talking about, I was very conscious of, yeah, I'm the migrant golfer, but wasn't able to bring it through, or didn't bring it through.
Okay, well, maybe that's a good point at which to stop. Thank you very much, Corinne.
Thank you so much.